Okay, I'm here with Emily James and James Leadbitter, the director, editor, and camera person for the film Just Do It, who are here in Sheffield at the Sheffield Doc Fest for a screening and world premiere of the film tomorrow evening, Thursday the 9th, at 6:35 in Showroom 4. Right, amazing project, I think, you guys have put together.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm awestruck by it. I'm kind of blown away by just your website. You know, it's like this.
I think we've got a new one launched today.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Because that was the website that was kind of supporting the crowdfunding appeal and stuff while we were in production.
Uh-huh.
And now for the launch of the film, we're launching a new website.
Right.
So, you thought it'd be awesome.
I got the old one, and even the old one is like,
I know. It was a bit maybe too much, the old one. I don't know. It's all pared down now.
More clearly structured.
So, can you just give us an address for that so that people can.
JustDoItFilm.com.
JustDoItFilm.com. Okay, so look, I've seen you on video going up huge flights of stairs all the way up to this, wearing a t shirt that said, I survived 87.
Oh, yeah, I survived 87, yeah.
Yeah.
It was the very first video we made.
Yes. Right.
Yeah.
Back in the day.
Like March last year.
Yeah, somewhere. When we were all fresh.
We were all fresh and wide eyed and enthusiastic.
So you're all jaded now. You're kind of
beat down.
Beat down.
Beat down, burnt out.
So after this.
Cynical.
Yeah.
It's the long holiday. Is that the plan, or more of this?
Well, we're going to spend quite a lot of effort rolling the film out.
Uh-huh.
So we launch in cinemas nationally from the 15th of July,
right.
And we've planned it in a way so that we're, rather than sort of taking block bookings, we're doing one-off single events and having Q&As after every screening and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So. That's going to be quite intense and time-consuming
right.
for a while.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's the best way to really get the message of the film out and to really reach audiences.
Okay, then the message of the film, that seems like a good question to ask. What is the message of the film, then? Stand silent.
Do it. Yeah, just do it.
Just do it.
Participate, get involved, mm-hmm. do something. Don't just sit there.
If there's something in the world that is a problem, or if there's something in the world that is an injustice, you do have agency to change that, and you do have the ability to change that situation.
Mm-hmm.
So don't just sit back and complain about it.
No liberal complaints. A radical analysis and just do it.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Sounds good. Yeah, I just wanted to talk about the way it all came together. Whose idea was it?
Crowdfunding.
And the crowdsourcing as well,
yeah.
In terms of the production model.
Yeah, crowdsourcing of material and also kind of a huge amount of volunteer support that's gone in, you know, people giving their time very generously in order to make it happen. We've had over 100 people work on the film in some capacity or another.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, as with everything, I guess on some level it's a kind of needs-must thing. I started the project in 2009. I started filming, and I filmed for about a year, working with a kind of wide spectrum of people, but all drawn from this kind of greater community around Climate Camp and Plain Stupid and that kind of environmental direct action
mm-hmm.
crew. And I kind of had to keep it on the down low what I was doing while I was filming, because obviously there, you know, I kind of didn't want to stick my head above the parapet too high for lots of legal reasons
mm-hmm.
and risk to the people that I was filming with and stuff.
So you weren't a suspected spy at any point? Or
I hope not.
Infiltrator?
No, I don't think so.
So how did you cope with that? Because there's a lot of paranoia, especially around the Radcliffe stuff and the Nottingham. And
yeah, there's a lot of paranoia and a lot of secrecy. I mean, the secrecy is kind of understandable considering that people are doing things that, you know, the state considers to be illegal
mm-hmm.
and it's a, you know, I mean, that was one of the biggest challenges, early challenges of making the film, was just getting people to agree to be filmed at all. Was, you know, it took me probably 6 months of talking to people, trying to work out what their concerns were, trying to work out ways that it would be safe for them to do,
mm-hmm.
talking to lawyers that represented activists and trying to find out what the real risks were and kind of how it could be done safely. And so I did I developed what I called the security protocol for filming, which largely involved a kind of set of, well, firstly, the promise that the material wouldn't come out until their court cases had been resolved and completed.
Mm-hmm.
So that sort of mitigated a lot of risk. But it was in order to ensure that, I had to make sure that the material didn't fall into the hands of the authorities on accident. Mm-hmm. So I would always have like quite a lot of tape runners that I would organize at key moments to come and pick up tapes from me so that I was never going into an action carrying anything incriminating, and mm-hmm. that at key moments the material was taken away and taken to a safe house.
Okay.
And then also I didn't keep any written records of what I was filming so that there was no easy way for the authorities or the police to say, right, we'll have that tape and that tape because, mm-hmm. you know, we know those will be incriminating.
Okay.
The tapes weren't labeled in any sort of, I had a kind of encrypted coded system that it turned out even I couldn't decrypt. That made James's job really
exciting and
exciting and interesting. I saw all the tapes
nightmare.
You know, that you'd managed somehow to get into chronological order, and there were how many tapes?
Well, I think ultimately we ended up with about 420 hours.
Right. And so the bulk of the work is logging then, is it?
There's a huge amount of logging. And that, again, we were only able to do that because we had a lot of volunteer help. So we had over a dozen editors who took material away. Well, first we had a fantastic edit assistant, Nico, who came in and spent sort of 2 months just day in and day out capturing material and getting it onto hard drives and into the computers.
Mm-hmm.
And then other people would come along and try and help figure out what that material was, organize it into a meaningful kind of structure, and then feed that back to James, who could then start working that up into a kind of narrative of sorts.
Okay, so were you making the narrative as you went along, or did you have the narrative as the director already worked out, or is it? It's kind of less. Is it more of a flat structure than that?
Well, I think that the narrative, I mean, essentially came out of what material we had. So there was a straightforward calendar narrative of what I had filmed.
Mm-hmm.
The first very long assembly that we put together, which was sort of 6 hours or something, was just a very straightforward chronological kind of assembly of the material,
starting at the G20 right through to Copenhagen, and then a few things after that.
And then we started from there the very long and involved process of trying to turn that into a film.
And I guess originally we kind of had this chronological narrative that would just follow the events as they happened.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think when we constructed that, we found that there were problems with that and there were things that were missing from that. And then we were quite lucky then to bring in Kurt Enford, who's editor extraordinaire, who helped us kind of break out of that structure that we kind of locked ourselves into a bit, and jig things around a bit more and gave us more creative license so that things like character development and plot development and more subtle themes running through the film could come through. So
I guess that we must talk about the domestic extremist then. One of the characters in the film,
Marina Pepper. Yes,
she's not the only domestic extremist in the film.
James is also a
domestic extremist.
Well done. So you get a badge.
But really, even when we sat down to start post-production and start editing, aside from Marina Pepper, there wasn't really anybody else that I was absolutely sure was going to become a primary character in the film. And again, Kurt Enford really helped a lot with that, and just, you know, sorting the wheat from the chaff. And also because James and I knew these people as people, it was difficult for us to see them purely as characters on the screen, and he helped with that a lot. And I had started out thinking there would be 9 to 12 characters because I was really wanting to make sure that we respected the desire not to kind of hone in on individuals or kind of celebritize individuals. So I had sort of filmed with about 12 people, assuming that some of them would get lost in the edit and we might end up with 9. And Kurt came in and went, those are your 3 characters, and cut it all down to 3 people. And we kind of, James and I sat there going, okay. And then as soon as he left, we were like, put more people back in. Which he was fine with, because he was still supervising us from a distance and supervising in the loosest sense. But, you know, he was still involved and stuff. And I think, so in the end, we ended up with 6 people as the kind of core cast, with a few more that you meet a little bit more. But it was also slightly haphazard. You know, there were other characters, other people that I filmed with who were amazing, but the second half of the year, they just didn't do very much, and so their storyline didn't go anywhere. Okay. Or
how inconsiderate of them.
Yeah, you know, it's like, so, you know, if you're gonna, if
how dare you actually have a life?
Yeah,
you know. Well, and I guess the other difficult decision was, people might think that the decisions that we've made in the film, in terms of the edit and how we tell the story, are political decisions. Mm. And actually, in most instances, that actually wasn't the case.
Right.
Most of the decisions were made was, how does that person come across on camera? Are they concise? Are they moving beyond just top-level key messaging in terms of what they're saying?
Yeah.
And, you know, do they reoccur? And that dictated a lot of the material that we had. Sure. So it wasn't like we were saying, we're just going to go with these people because, you know, we want to sabotage them. Well, literally, we worked with the material that we could get.
And
dictated so much of it. Really.
No, absolutely. I mean, there was, although there's clearly active choices along the way, there's also much more just reactive to what were we able to capture, what happened that year. I mean, it was really chaotic, the shoot. But I didn't know who would be coming. I didn't know what, you know, often I didn't even know geographically where it was going to be. I would just be like, turn up with my camera and a rucksack and like a day's worth of food and water. So it was kind of trying to ensure that we had returning characters was something of a haphazard attempt. You know, somebody would walk, you know, be walking up to the meeting point and I'd go, oh, great, look, I've filmed with you before. All right, returning character. And, you know, so it was a little bit haphazard, and I did manage to start getting returning characters, people. And then once I had filmed with somebody a couple of times, I'd then try and go and do an interview with them at their house or something to kind of try and get behind the scenes of that with them and stuff. But really, even when we sat down to start post-production and start editing, aside from Marina Pepper, there wasn't really anybody else that I was absolutely sure was going to become a primary character in the film. And unfortunately, the film is a little bit London-centric.
Uh-huh.
You know, most of the characters in the film sort of live in and about London. Marina was living in Brighton and then in the Isle of Wight, and I went to quite a lot of effort to make sure that there was at least one story in the film that wasn't in London. If I had only gone someplace one time and there was no returning characters in that storyline, those were the stories that fell by the wayside because you just couldn't get them to stick.
So there's a lot of good shit on the cutting room floor.
On the cutting room floor, but it just didn't fit in anymore in the narrative.
And there's DVD extras.
There's some good DVD extras. There's definitely
hard for me, like the Clambrush Chatham House.
The Chatham House action.
Which was wonderful because it was going to be the second action in the film, and it was a failed action. It was an action that went wrong.
Okay.
It was picked out when they got there.
Right.
Yeah.
And we thought that was wonderful because we'd start with the main action in detail. We'd start and it would fail, and that would be a good way to kind of show the complexity of doing that acting.
How
many ways it can go wrong. And we cut it, and it was good, and we had put some voiceover in, put some animation in. So there, and
it was our favourite action.
And I think it was me who actually said, "No, we need to cut it."
Right.
Even though I'd probably spent about 4 weeks editing.
Yeah, and it was my favourite. It was been the way that I had wanted to open the film forever, and it was really, you know. But and the reason that it got cut was for no other reason except for that we had narrowed it down to the key characters. Marina was the only remaining key character that was in that storyline, and we already had way too many other storyline scenes with her, and the other ones were crucial to understanding the narrative of her year, and that one wasn't. And so our favourite action had to fall to on the cutting room floor because it just didn't fit into a coherent narrative. But
it's a DVD extra.
It is a DVD extra.
Just when you're talking about going out on an action, I remember it's kind of took me back somehow to my first going out on an action as a kind of with a stills camera on a hunt sap.
Right.
Same, you know, bag of food and in a Land Rover into a muddy field. Where's the fox? No, and this was 1980s. There were no mobile phones, nothing. It was just over there. And at one point, one of the activists got run over by somebody in a Jeep, by one of the people who were defending the hunt. Yeah, and so rather than take pictures of this, I just ran at the Jeep and started trying to smash the window in.
Mm.
So I found I couldn't separate myself out and just stand there in a kind of cold way and take the pictures, which was the important thing to do, I think. I should have done that.
Rather than going to try to break the window.
I don't think you can make a black and white mould distinction, that kind of thing.
No, I don't think you can.
And there's plenty of instances in the footage, maybe not in the film, of Emily piping up from behind the camera going, what about if we do this? Or, I've got this information.
That was actually the hard thing. It was often when I had information that they didn't have, like on the Ratcliffe and Soar thing, on the Great Climate Sweep, I had filmed a recce so I had gone filming with people who had been on the recce, and then on the day I was with an affinity group of people, most of whom had never been to the power station before and didn't know the lay of the land.
Right.
So I had a huge amount of valuable information and I would see them like running off in a direction and be like, that doesn't go anywhere! This way!
Well, you're the director.
I was supposed to say that. Yeah. You know, I did find it a little bit hard to like completely stay kind of, you know, but at the same time I think like, for me, this film really kind of took me back to my roots in a way, because I've not done a lot of observational filmmaking. Most of my films are much more kind of scripted and constructed.
Right.
But I started out way back when, back in the 90s, studying university and doing visual anthropology and ethnographic filmmaking. And that really was about, that kind of, for me, is... This film really took me back to that. And I learned in that a kind of approach to filmmaking, which was about getting to know a culture, getting to understand it, and getting to know it by participating in it, and then trying to then make something out of that, make a film that captured that, the essence of that, and not just on a kind of literal, kind of objective narrative sense, but also kind of from a creative level as well. And it was about... like kind of participant observation. And so I think, you know, along the way in making this film, I don't think that the people that I was filming with would have trusted me as much or been as willing to kind of go along the journey with me if I had spent the whole time going, no, you can't borrow my pen because the legal people told me that if I help you in any way, then I'm, you know, then I'm aiding and abetting.
Uh-huh.
I'd be like, yes, of course you can borrow my pen, you know? So I think that, you know, that I believe in them. I believe in what they do. I think that they're, you know, I do believe they have the moral high ground, and I was never going to sort of
pretend that I didn't. Yeah. And pretend that you had some objective...
Yeah, I don't believe in objectivity. I think it's nonsense. We're all subjective beings, the idea that you can kind of somehow create, you know... I mean, you can put rules in place about behaviour that help you to achieve something closer to objectivity, and that's, you know, what the scientific method is for.
Uh-huh.
And that's very good. But I think as a filmmaker in this sense... I think that I tried to make an accurate portrait, and understanding the people and where they were coming from and why they did it was an important part of enabling me to make an accurate portrait.
Well, that's how it comes across to me, anyway. But there you go.
Great!
Job done!
Just come down and watch it, folks.
So, Justio, A Tale of Modern Day Outlaws will be receiving its world premiere here in Sheffield tomorrow, that's Thursday, at 6:35 at the Showroom Cinema number 4. If you want to come, there are still public tickets available, but I suggest you act now. You can book online because there's not that many public tickets left. We have been assured that if all the public tickets sell out, they may release some of the delegate tickets so that more public can come. And we really want as many people to come as possible. It's not a film that we made to show it to lots of other filmmakers and industry people. So it's quite important to us that, you know, the local public come and check it out.
And also, just as another thing, you came and cut the story, a short film. He's on Thursday at 3:30 and on Saturday at 1:35.
Oh, have you been involved with that?
I haven't, no.
But
just thought I'd plug it.
But we will keep their case.
Great.
And I think there's a few people from the UK coming down for that.
Yes.
And Playing Studio will come to have a discussion about it. So.
Yeah.
Fabulous.
Yeah.
Great meeting you.
And you.